Wonderful. Now it gets interesting. Chris Smith, and then let's get in on the queue. If you've got one, just say the word.
Important point to register, I think, here, and you know this, but just want to draw it out explicitly. When surveying evangelicals, there are multiple ways to possibly identify them.
Yeah.
And so my specific question is, what measure did you use? Mm-hmm. And then my commentary is, you know, it can be self-identity, it can be denominational location, it can be theological, and depending on the measure we use, we can get quite different results.
Yeah.
I think your data look great, but I just want to, partly just for the educational benefit, to point out the measure, especially with evangelicals, really matters, and I'm just curious which one you relied on. The second point I wanted to make was, you say evangelicals aren't leaving, white evangelicals aren't sort of departing because of the Trump effect, but sometimes these things happen as lag effects. So it could be, if Trump had a second term, it could be near the end of the second term, you might start seeing much more of an exodus. That's speculation, but just, we've only had 3 years of the guy, so, well, anyway, so.
Yeah.
And one quick comment for Daniel. You rightly say on the social networks thing, there's, you're not specifying any causal order, but you twice use the verb impact. Once hugely impacts, saying networks hugely impacts religion. It could be that people's religious location forms who they choose to be friends with. So I hear you saying technically you're not making causal claims, but you actually really believe the networks drive the religion.
Yeah, so no, right, I shouldn't use impact, but there's a strong causal relationship. So certainly people who can move to certain states if they like better agree with the religious demonic event, they prefer that kind of,
Yes, great question. I'm glad you raised it because the measurement of evangelicalism is near and dear to my heart. I think it's a really interesting topic. At Pew Research Center, we've used two approaches to measure evangelicalism. In the big religious landscape studies, we've used a detailed set of denominational questions. So I mentioned that first question we ask people, what's your religion, Protestant, Catholic, so on and so forth. If you say you're Protestant, you get a second question. What church or denomination is that? Are you Baptist, Methodist, Lutheran, Episcopalian, Presbyterian? I'm not going to remember the whole question, but there's about 12 or 14 different options for people to choose from. And then, based on their answers to that second question, people get a third question. So Presbyterians are asked, is that the Presbyterian Church in America, an evangelical denomination, or is it the Presbyterian Church USA, a mainline denomination? So we try to get as specific as we can about the denomination with which one identifies. And then we categorize people into either an evangelical category, a mainline Protestant category, or a historically black Protestant category based on their denominational affiliation. So that's one way to do it, and there's all kinds of complexities in that we can get into more. The other way we've done it, and the way that, at least historically, we've done it more often, is much more straightforward. We ask people the first question I mentioned, and then, if you're Christian, you get a follow-up question. Do you think of yourself as a born-again or evangelical Christian or not? People can say yes or no. And then we take people who describe their race as white and who describe their religion as Protestant and who described and who said yes to that born-again or evangelical Christian question, and we call them white evangelical Protestants. That's the measure that I used in those slides that were looking at changes in the share of Americans who are white evangelical Protestants. The reason I use that measure here is two reasons. One is that there's been so much interesting commentary and conversation since really 2015, certainly 2016, about what it means to be evangelical, and conversation specifically about the evangelical label. I wish I had it. I don't. So please don't quote me on this. I'm going to paraphrase, but in a lot of presentations, I like to share a quote from Russell Moore, who is, I forget his exact title. He's with the Religious and Ethics
Director of the Eisenhower Religious Liberty Convention.
The Southern Baptist Convention, right. Yep. Yes. He had an article in the Washington Post, I think it was early in 2016, in response to polls that were finding high levels of support for Trump among evangelicals. And he said, chances are if you tell a pollster on the phone that you are an evangelical Christian, you may well be drunk right now and haven't been to church since Seinfeld was in first run episodes. And the idea was, how can someone who is an evangelical Christian possibly support Donald Trump? That's been the line of commentary. And many people have suggested that what you're seeing here is that actually what's happening is it's evangelicals who aren't particularly religious who are most supportive of Donald Trump. So that's been the conversation, and because of that, we've done a lot of digging over the last few years into what difference does the measurement make. And I don't think the measurement makes too much difference, at least not in terms of those two ways of doing it. The people who identify with white, to the yes or no question, as white, born again, or evangelical Protestants, are deeply religious on average. They long have been. They're strongly Republican. They long have been. They're strongly supportive of Donald Trump. They long have been. It's not a different group of people than the people who have been Republican in previous presidential elections. And if you look at the denominational approach, you see very much the same thing. We have more data on the yes or no question because we ask it on all of our political surveys and have going back decades. I can't remember exactly when we started, but it's an easy question to ask in the demographics of a political survey. The detailed questions designed to get specifics on people's denominational affiliation requires a lot of questions, a lot of space on a survey. So we've done it on our big religious landscape surveys, but have less data on it on our political surveys. One last point. There are other ways of measuring evangelicalism. You mentioned beliefs. The National Association of Evangelicals came out a few years ago, I think it was 2016, maybe 2015, suggesting that the best way to measure evangelicalism is to ask people about their beliefs, four specific beliefs in particular. Other groups, I'm thinking here of the Barna Research Group. They have a very strict set of criteria for who counts as an evangelical. I think they have 9 specific individual qualifications that someone must meet to be an evangelical. So their estimate of the size of the evangelical population is much, much smaller than some of these other estimates. So it can make a big difference. But with respect to the specifics about the denominational approach as opposed to the yes-no, I think they paint a similar picture of the public.
Madeline Kearns, NRI.
I think my first question is probably for you, Daniel. I was interested that you said that in the past, when a religious and a secular person married, it tended to make the secular person more religious over time. Do you find that the reverse is true, given that there's a kind of more dominant secular cultural narrative, so people who might be religious marrying secular people and then abandoning their religion? And then the next question would be for you, Greg, and it's, I'm very interested in the sort of breakdown in terms of what would be traditionally known as culture war issues. So I'm thinking of things like abortion or LGBT and that kind of thing, because it's been my, it's purely anecdotal, but it's been my experience that quite often Hispanic or African-American Democrats would be very, very socially conservative on those issues. And how do you sort of make sense of those sorts of divides?
That's a terrific question. So could there be a pull towards secular identity or belief in the context of marriage? We know that partners and spouses have a tremendous impact on a lot of our behavior, including religious. My sense is that the connection to religious community really matters. So if I'm secular marrying a Catholic, chances are that my spouse has a lot of ties, whether familial or community ties to an actual congregation, which I think would not work in reverse, right? There's not a lot of sort of institutional support for secular identities. So I think that's probably unlikely, although it's something that definitely is worth watching.
One of the things we've seen in our data is that people who are in religiously mixed marriages, which could include a something and a nothing, so to speak, you know, a Christian and somebody who's not religious. It could include a Catholic and a Protestant. People who are in religiously mixed marriages tend to be less religious than people who are married to someone who shares the same religion. That's a pretty consistent pattern. One thing that's always occurred to me, though, is that what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Is it that being married to someone who doesn't share your religion depresses your own religiosity because you don't have that reinforcement? Or is it that people for whom religion isn't all that important are more inclined to marry someone who doesn't share their religion in the first place? I mean, if religion isn't that important to you and it's not that important to your spouse, even if you have some kind of familiar or vestigial connection to religion, that could lead to the match in the first place. So I don't know how to untangle that exactly. I guess we could follow people over time, or I don't think we could randomly assign people in an experiment to try to figure that out. But it's an interesting puzzle. In terms of social issues and determinants and culture war, and how does that factor into what we're seeing, I guess I'd point to a couple things. One is that we've seen over the last few decades big change in public opinion about some culture war issues, specifically pretty much anything having to do with homosexuality, whether it's support for same-sex marriage or support for allowing same-sex couples to adopt children or allowing gay and lesbian people to serve in the military, you name it. There's growing acceptance of homosexuality, of same-sex marriage across the board, across the religious spectrum. Now, to be sure, there are still big differences between religious groups in their attitudes on these questions. Mormons and evangelical Christians are much more conservative when it comes to their attitudes on those questions than are mainline Protestants and Catholics, who in turn are more conservative than people who have no religion. But the direction of the trend in opinion is in the same way on all of those, among all of those groups. Evangelical Christians are still conservative, but they're more accepting today than they were in the past. That's not true on all culture war issues. Abortion, for example, at least insofar as we've measured it, public opinion is much more stable. There's more support for legal abortion than there is opposition, but you haven't seen the same kind of dramatic generational change that we've seen over the last couple of decades with respect to homosexuality. And you're right, and I think those data, some of the data I shared, hint at that there are differences within the Democratic Party in the social conservatism of black Protestants, many of whom self-identify as born-again or evangelical Christians, as opposed to white religious nuns. They're going to look different on some political issues. One of the things I think is important to keep in mind, and this can be a challenge, it's certainly a challenge for me because I spend most of my waking hours thinking about religion and often religion and politics, is that politics isn't always about religion. There are many other factors that people bring to the table when it comes time to think about politics, to make political decisions, to vote in elections. Questions about racial justice, questions about the economy, attitudes about immigration, attitudes about taxation, attitudes about foreign policy. There's a whole panoply of topics and issues that may be more or less related to religion that people bring with them into the ballot box. And I think that helps to understand and helps to explain some kind of the coalitional nature of our partisan politics. I'll leave it at that. I've got other... I'm tempted to say a few words about parallels between Trump and Romney and evangelicals in the Republican Party, but maybe we can get into that later. So.
Megan Clark with Religion Unplugged.
Hi. Okay, so you just kind of answered one of my questions, but I can ask it if you want to add anything on to it. I now also have a follow-up question, but I was wondering, it seems like the general theme is that young people in America are moving more left politically, but also these progressive mainline Protestant denominations also seem to be declining. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. So I'm just wondering why that is. And like, there was a recent New York Times article about a church in New York that was a Presbyterian church that really welcomed people that were not even religious, yeah, or were, you know, like they were atheists. There were also Jews and Muslims that came, and yeah, like the sermon was on GMO vegetables and the dangers, mm-hmm, of eating them. And like they're really united by this shared sense of gloom about Trump. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's like, well, that's interesting. Maybe anger about Trump makes people more religious in some sense. And then my follow-up question is, like, within American Christianity, are there actually any Christian groups that are increasing, and what are they? And what about immigrant groups like African Anglicans or Coptic Christians?
Yeah.
I'll jump in at the end, Rick.
Start. You've hit on something that's long puzzled me. So we don't have data that speak directly to this, but there is a prominent and I think well-supported idea among many scholars, probably first offered by sociologists, Mike Howden and Claude Fisher, and more recently political scientists Dave Campbell and Robert Putnam, that there's a connection between religiosity, there's a connection between politics and the decline of religion in the United States. And the idea is that part of the growth of the nuns can be attributed to the fact that part of what's happening is that people who don't share the conservative politics of religious groups, of Christianity, are leaving Christianity and they're becoming nuns. That begs the question then, why is it that more liberal Christian denominations, mainline Protestantism in particular, why is it that they're declining more quickly than evangelical Protestant denominations? That it would seem like if that's what was at play, then it should be the most conservative religious groups that are declining as a share of the population. But in fact, we know mainline Protestantism, which is less conservative, less at least politically, than evangelical Protestant, is declining faster. Why is that? I think the answer is that, I think this is the case, that it's not so much the conservatism of any particular denomination that might lead people away from religion. It's the association of religion with conservatism kind of in the popular imagination. It's the idea, whether it's true of any particular group, that to be religious means to be politically conservative. And that might, I think that might explain the answer to your question. I would also say, though, if you're interested in exploring that further, those would be great people to reach out to, and I know they'd be more than happy to talk with you, especially Dave Campbell at the University of Notre Dame is terrific on this. Are there any Christian groups that are growing, perhaps as a result of immigration? Not that I'm aware of. There are differences in the rate of decline across Christian groups. I mentioned that mainline Protestantism is declining faster than evangelicalism. Mormons, the share of Americans who identify with Mormonism doesn't seem to be declining. It seems to be holding steady at about 2% of the population, as does the share of Americans who identify with Orthodox Christianity at a little less than 1% of the population. Within Protestantism, we can see areas of growth. Pentecostal churches and non-denominational churches are growing within Protestantism. While Protestantism is declining, there's pockets of growth there.
Is there truth in the claim that immigration is helping the Catholic Church?
Yes, that's what I was just going to touch on. Immigration is so interesting, though, because it is serving to reinforce the Christian character of the United States. It's not leading to growth necessarily as a share of the population in any particular Christian group, but it is stemming the decline. It is slowing the decline. Catholics are so interesting in this respect. Catholics lose more people through religious switching than any other religious group we're able to examine. 13% of American adults, more than one out of every 10 people you come in contact with on the street, assuming you're coming into a contact with a random sample of the national population, are former Catholics. 13%. These are people who say they were raised Catholic and no longer identify as such. They're now religious nuns or Protestants for the most part. Some of them have gone to other religions, but those are the two big destinations. Now, there's also millions of converts to Catholicism within the American public, millions. But the share of the population that are Catholic now and say they've become Catholic as adults after having been raised as something else is more like 2.5%. So you've got 13% who say they're former Catholics, 2.5% who say they're Catholic converts. That means there's 6 former Catholics for every 1 convert to Catholicism. And there's no other religious group that has anything like that ratio. Now, that doesn't mean Catholics do a bad job retaining their members. They do. They keep most people who are raised Catholic are still Catholic, and the share of people who are raised Catholics who are still Catholic compares pretty favorably to what you see among other religious groups. But other religious groups do a better job of attracting new members, of attracting converts, especially evangelicals. So Catholics are losing people through religious switching faster than any other group. So how can it be then, if you remember that GSS slide, that the share of the population who identifies as Catholic has been so steady over all these decades at about 1/4 of the population? I think the answer has to do with immigration. Immigration, especially from Latin America. Catholic immigration, especially from South America, has helped to stem the losses that you otherwise would have seen in the Catholic share of the population. So that, I think, is one key way that immigration is impacting the shape of the American religious landscape.
I would just add, Michelle Margolis might be someone you want to talk to as well. She has a great new book out, I think it was last year. And then Greg, I think it's right on the members of the LDS Church. The best estimates we have is that's remaining relatively stable. I looked at this for a Vox piece I wrote maybe earlier this year, and trying to explore the reasons behind that. And a lot of it, I think, is how members of the LDS Church approach family. So Mormons tend to get married a lot earlier. They have much larger families, and there's a huge emphasis on bringing families into the church. Not that there isn't in other traditions, but the Mormons seem to do it fairly effectively, and that, I think, guards against a lot of the sort of religious disaffiliation that we see late teen years, college age years.
Jack Jenkins, the news service.
A couple questions. First for Dan. One of these last slides about young adults are more likely to know an atheist than an evangelical Christian is fascinating to me for multiple reasons. Because one, you would think it's intuitive, like, oh, well, there are fewer religiously affiliated, but we know that religious affiliated doesn't necessarily mean atheist, but there's probably still more atheists in the younger group than there are in older categories. But there's still not that many atheists, and there's still a whole lot of evangelical Christians. And so I'm curious if there's any more data about, geographic distribution of this, or why that might be the case, because it looks like only less than half of 18 to 29 year olds even know an evangelical Christian, despite the fact that they still make up a sizable chunk of the U.S. population. So I'm just curious about any sort of additional data on that. For Greg, I have a weird technical question, which is that this is also fascinating. This, but the line squiggle. So I'm just curious if Pew knows the future. I'm curious.
Yes, we do.
Okay, because it's the whole sections were it's happening in 2040, where there's a little dip, and I didn't know if they're predicting certain demographic changes. And for both of you, since we were talking about religious identity, I am curious about, obviously there's self-IDing. You were talking about how do you self-ID evangelical. But is there any discussion about other new categories, right? So where some of the things you were talking about politically, just saying that someone's an evangelical or saying someone's, Presbyterian Church America is not necessarily, as you noted, the pure indicator of how they might vote. And so I'm curious if there have been other categorical discussions about whether it's Christian nationalism or certain pan ideas that seem to group people together that have some sort of religious tie, if there has been any conversation in the polling world of new categories.
Mm-hmm. All right. So starting with the atheists. Evangelical Christians, there's multiple ways to measure atheists. It's both a belief and an identity measure. So the way a lot of times is reported out, it's the identity measure. So how many people identify as atheists, but more people will actually say they don't believe in God than will identify as atheists. There's also a lot more fluidity in the certainty or comments people have about their belief in God. So We earlier this year piloted a new measure of religious belief that just provided a 10-point scale anchored by I believe in God with absolute certainty, and I do not believe in God with absolute certainty. There's a lot more fluidity in the, you know, the relative beliefs of folks than you might imagine. So even among the most religious and least religious groups, there's the title report was Doubting Disbelievers, because we actually, before now, hadn't measured the amount of confidence non-believers had. So if you're an atheist, how much doubt do you have about your non-belief? Well, it turns out there's a significant amount. And so it's the picture is pretty complicated when measuring. We know from the identity measure that, you know, significantly more young people are identifying as atheist. But is that a question of whether they just feel more comfortable with the label because they feel like their peers aren't going to judge them? Or is it actually that they're more likely to be atheist? And I think that's a little bit of an open question.
Thank you for asking about that slide. It's page 17 if anybody's interested in looking back at it. These data are based on research that our demographers have done that do project the future. They don't predict the future. Conrad would get very upset with me if I said these were predictions. They're not. They're projections. And this is far afield from my own research, so take this with a grain of salt, but I'll try to explain what they've done here. What Conrad and his team have done is they've taken data from all around the world. They've got data on the vast majority of countries in the world. There's a few they can't get data on, North Korea, a few others. They've taken data on every country in the world, looked at the religious composition of those of each country, looked at the age distribution of people within those religions, which religions tend to have more young people who are either in childbearing years now or will be in childbearing years over the next couple of decades, and how many of them have older people whose fertility is completed. They've looked at fertility rates and how they vary by religion, which religious groups tend to have more children than other religious groups. They've also factored in things like some religious switching, although there's less data available on that. They may have taken into account things like life expectancy, which varies around the world, you know, and using all of that information, they can look at the current state of the world today, how many people are there from various religious groups, what's their age structure, how many children do they tend to have, what's life expectancy in the places that they live, how many of them are likely to change their religion. You can look at that and then project forward. If the trends that we see are underway today continue moving forward, what will the world look like in 2015. What will it look like in 2020, 2030, 2040, 2050? So that's how these projections are made. If one of those inputs changes, then the outcomes will change. So if there's a sudden spike in the share of people who switch from Christianity to no religion, for example, that'll change these numbers. Alternatively, if there's a sudden spike in the share of people who leave the religious nuns and become religious, that would change these numbers. If there's some kind of big shock to the system in terms of life expectancy or fertility rates, something of that, these things could change. But that's basically what these data reflect. So good question. Thank you for asking that. In terms of other categories, changing categories, that's an interesting question. There's certainly discussion of it. There's been a lot of discussion in recent years about what's the best way to measure and conceive of evangelicalism. There's also a lot of discussion, and people have employed different methods of asking about Christian nationalism. There's been talk over the years of ways to measure kind of para-church or para-religious organizations. Think charismatic Christianity, renewalist Christianity. So there's kind of constant discussion of those things. I'm not sure, though, that there's any one kind of new approach we can point to that's going to be the wave of the future. Part of that is practical. If you want to measure change, you can't change the measures. If you want to know how the world is changing, if you want to know if there are more Catholics today or fewer, if there are more evangelicals or fewer, you can't change the way you ask about those things. So in some ways, the more you ask about these things, the more you get locked into asking them the way you do. At Pew Research Center, we have long, involved, knockdown, drag-out fights about, and they're friendly, but about whether to, when we're designing surveys on exactly this topic. We know that there are, there's no such thing as a perfect survey question. You can always improve your survey questions. There are survey questions that might have been great in the 1980s that maybe are less pertinent today. And so you find yourselves in these conversations where you're constantly weighing potential benefits from maybe improving your measures on the one hand against the cost of losing the trend on the other if you change the way you ask about these things. So that's an interesting element of the discussion as we move forward about what are new and better and alternative ways of measuring these things. It's interesting to think about.
I might just add that increasingly trying to sort out like cultural identity, so cultural Catholics, people who are culturally Jewish, would be helpful. I know a few folks have done it, and I think it'd be really interesting to note if we're seeing sort of growth in that area, you know, and what does it mean to be sort of culturally Hindu or culturally Muslim as opposed to, you know, strictly religious. So I think that, and then there's the debate about spirituality, right, which is like, I've tried to measure it unsuccessfully. I think it just correlates strongly with religious measures. So the GSS has questions about, are you a spiritual person? Are you a religious person? You know, I don't put a lot of faith in those measures because I think so much of it's subjective. So whatever you're pouring in there will impact the results. But I think they're, you know, if someone could go to figure that out, because, you know, it'd be interesting to know if young people today, if they're, religious disaffiliation is driven by just institutional distrust, but they remain largely interested in sort of spiritual concepts and ideas, and maybe they're, you know, an institution that was providing that. But I think first we got to figure out, yeah, just how to measure that.
I think this slide 17 is really interesting, and some of us were in a meeting with some folks at the State Department yesterday for lunch, and they were talking about categories that people use to describe people abroad, and very, very frequently, it's not in sort of religious terms. It's ethnic, it's cultural alone. And I think part of what we're trying to do is reintroduce that lens as part of the vocabulary. It's pretty great having people who you push, you know, push in, there's like more data, not less data, which is refreshing. So projecting the future super hard, I'm going to suggest modestly that we take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and we'll hear from Aaron Covey, from Graham Weiss, from Derek Thompson, and from Roeda, and then we'll keep the conversation going. So a 10-minute break. Restrooms are straight out to the left. All right. Well, first question up comes from Aaron Covey. So we'll go for one more hour and then take a little break again before the lunch hour. We'll have some visits in and out over the course of the day. Tonight we'll get a little visitor swinging by for just a little short portion of the cocktail hour, describing another little writing opportunity, and there will be some journalists in and out throughout the time. First up is Aaron Covey of NPR.
Yeah, so my first question was kind of a follow-up to Megan's question. I was curious about the difference in decline between mainline Protestantism and evangelicalism, and I was wondering if you had any data that could, like, attribute that to just population growth and maybe, like, evangelical Christianity placing a higher emphasis on marriage and childbirth, and whether that just numbers had to do with that decline, and whether we might see, like, a greater decline in the next couple of years. And then my second question had to do with this last slide about young adults being more likely to know an atheist than an evangelical, which is super interesting to me. And I'm wondering if that has to do with the fact that evangelical Christians who may self-identify to a pollster don't self-identify to their coworkers and a lot of other people just because of the connotations of the term, and whether you had looked into that at all. I'm also super interested in seeing regional data with that.
Got it. So I'll handle the second question. I don't know if, Greg, you want to handle the first one.
And a brief word about pace. We're going to try to get more questions in rather than less. So we're like aiming for, you know, more like the cable news, the news hour. 90 seconds. Nice thing. I think it'll get more people in.
I think isn't any great data that I've seen that suggests that younger evangelical Christians are sort of hiding their identity from their peers. I recently wrote about a piece about young white evangelical Christians, and I did some interviews with about half a dozen of them. And you know what I heard was they don't talk politics with a lot of their peers because of the strong differences they have, in particularly in the Trump era, where you know there's people who are drawing bright lines between your you know either for or against your side A or side B. But I do think that there's questions on you know what the label means. So a lot of the younger folks I talked to talked about like reclaiming the label of evangelical identity and how that was important to them. And it's a really interesting cohort because they are kind of situated between sort of a conservative theology and religious family, and then their peers who are largely in very different places on a whole host of issues, whether it's marijuana legalization, gay marriage. So, for instance, a slim majority of younger white evangelicals actually support same-sex marriage now, according to recent data. But the overwhelming majority of older white evangelicals still oppose it. But their peers, again, are largely supportive. So they are kind of caught in that kind of world, and I think they're navigating it. But it's changing how they think about, I think, like religious exclusivism. So the idea that you know only one type of belief can get you into heaven. So like they're becoming much more pluralistic, younger white evangelicals, in their approach to religion than previous generations. And I think it's because they have friends who are atheists and Muslim and Buddhist and Catholic. That plays a pretty significant role.
Yeah, so in terms of the different rates of change within the evangelical and the mainline Protestant communities, it is true that mainline Protestantism is declining faster than evangelical Protestantism. And here I'm talking about the denominational approach to measuring them. These are people who identify with evangelical and mainline denominations. Between 2007 and 2014, the share who identify with evangelical denominations ticked downward, but only just a little bit, from 26% to 25%. Meanwhile, the share of adults identifying with mainline denominations dropped by 3 points, from 18% to 15%. We can see furthermore that mainline Protestants, between those two studies, declined in absolute terms. There were about 5 million fewer mainline Protestants in the United States in 2014 than there were in 2007. That is not true for evangelical Protestantism. The number of evangelical Protestants in the United States is steady or maybe even growing slightly. So those two groups are on very different trajectories. I do think that demographic factors, age and fertility, have something to do with it. Evangelical Protestants are a little bit younger on average than mainline Protestants. The median age for evangelicals is 49. It's 52 for mainline Protestants. So not a huge difference, but a difference nonetheless. And in terms of fertility, average family size, evangelical Protestants with completed fertility. So this is among people ages 40 to 59, people who have completed their childbearing years, at least according to demographers. They had 2.3 children on average compared to 1.9 children on average for mainline Protestants. So yes, I think that's a big part of the story there. I'm reading the Religious Landscape Study. I didn't bring copies for everybody, but
we all
these
thought
statistics,
you had that memorized.
No, yeah. All these statistics are in there.
Grambling.
I have a question about this religious realignment among liberals chart, which begins in 1988 and goes to the present. I was born in 1989, so this is sort of like my life laid out here. And I'm curious, is this a trend that began in the late 80s and you know, not a continuation of something that sort of began earlier? And if so, what is going on culturally at that pivot point that sort of begins this trend?
Yeah, so if we ran the whole trend to the early 70s, there's some wiggling, obviously, with the data, in the estimates. But overall, the difference between liberals and conservatives is relatively small throughout the time period. And in the early 90s, that's when everything begins, right? We've seen the jump in non-religious identity increasing. And this is something that we're still looking at. Again, some political scientists have looked at sort of the political causes of disaffiliation. But I tend to think that it's not, certainly not just politics, that sort of family environment, family factors play a pretty significant role as well. And it's one of the reasons I think that this, you know, we're going to increasingly see this growth, this sort of separation between liberals and conservatives, because it's not just identity. If you look at patterns of attendance too, we see this, again, this widening of attendance patterns between liberals and conservatives.
And these are factors that sort of began to play a role in the early 90s, or late.
Yeah, and again, it's sort of speculative, but if you look at sort of the media coverage, and I do think that plays a pretty significant role, like how the media portrayed religious-based activism during that time period, it was in opposition to abortion or same-sex marriage. And so that was what, you know, if you were certainly not that religiously committed or sort of outside of religious tradition, and then your exposure to what religion means in the public square was gleaned through the media, you're seeing a story that's pretty one-sided. So you aren't seeing about the, you know, the soup kitchens, the sort of local charity drives and the other activities, the sort of important public roles that churches and houses of worship play. You're seeing this really sort of hard edge, sort of conservative drive, because like that's who got on TV. Yeah.
Eric Thompson. Well, first, Fran, stole my question. I can chat.
Comment on the question. Oh, okay. So first, I wonder whether, as you guys were talking about how mainline Protestantism is declining faster than evangelicals, that you see really no decline among the Mormon population. Are you familiar with the theory of why strict churches are strong by Iannacone? I feel like I'll for those who don't know it, I'll do my best to summarize it. But I'd actually like to hear you comment on that a bit. He was an economist who basically looked at religion through an economic lens and said, why is it that in a period, the paper was originally written, I think, in the early 1990s, why in a period where you see declining religiosity, do you also see an increase or at least stability among religions that you would consider strict? Strict religions have a higher social cost. And he said, well, it has a higher social cost, but it also buys a better religious product. The religious product here not only being the tenets of the faith, but also the quality of the community, that strict churches are better at weeding out free riders, and so it puts you in a room with people that are very like-minded, in the same way that it's just better to be a part of any community where everyone's in on whatever the idea is. It's just, it feels better to be a part of a congregation when everyone is really enthusiastically behind you, and that strict churches are better at creating that community. So I'm really curious to the degree to which either of you think that there's an element of that, in addition to what I think is very clearly a big point here, which is the fertility aspect, that just Mormons and evangelicals are just having more kids. So even if you have some kids dropping off and changing your religion, you simply have a bigger base to build on going forward. The other thing my question was just going to be what the heck happened in the 1990s, because Daniel, in your graph on page two, it really is remarkable the degree to which non-affiliation, which has basically been stable for the previous 20 years, doubles in 10 years in the 1990s and is on pace to double again in the last 20 years. Something has changed. I don't think it's just media representation, although I don't think that it's media representation plays no role. My guess is that a large part of it does have to do with the fact that religiosity, especially Christianity, has become associated with conservatism at the exact same time that young generations have become extremely liberal, not just more liberal than the rest of the country, but significantly more liberal than previous generations of young Americans. And I think that has to do with the fact that at the national level, issues like abortion, which had no clear political distinction between Democrats and Republicans and before, say, the 1970s, before Roe v. Wade, like Richard Nixon was relatively ambivalent on the issue, became clearly divided, became a cultural flashpoint where Democrats and Republicans chose sides that they haven't budged from in the last 40 years. And I wonder the degree to which you have, A, the nationalization of cultural flashpoints between the parties, and then, B, people essentially associating religiosity, especially Christian religiosity, with the Republican Party, are choosing to disaffiliate with religion in part because they're choosing essentially to disaffiliate with the Republican Party.
I don't know if we're allowed to do this, but I'd prefer to defer to Christian Smith on the first question about Strip Church.
Why the 90s question?
Okay.
Please put that mic on if you don't mind.
I would just mention that it's not that conservative churches aren't losing no members. In fact, according to the Southern Baptist Convention's own numbers, they've lost 1 million members over the last decade. So it's not that they're immune from these trends. That we're just seeing it's not as severe, like the losses.
Right.
I also think it's more difficult. When you're embedded in a community that you're going to two or three times a week, when all your friends are members of that church or denomination, it becomes the costs you pay for leaving are extremely high, much higher than for liberal denominations. So you have, weekly attendance, and half your friends are outside the church, half are there. Because if you leave a conservative church, you're sort of that part of your life, you're sort of like just it's gone, and like there's not a ready-made replacement. I don't know if either of you would disagree with that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
No, that's right. And Aaron's question too. I mean, part of the fertility has to do with the timing of the changes. So mainline Protestants adopted birth control much, much earlier in the 20th century than evangelicals. So you're talking about little differences playing out over long periods of time that mainliners have had a longer period of time of having fewer children, and it just adds up. Fertility isn't, I totally agree with both panels. It's not the total answer, but it's a huge chunk of the answer.
And Chris, do I remember correctly that you did a book some years ago about evangelicals? The subtitle was Embattled and Thriving?
Yes.
That seems to link onto the point Derek made too. That sort of happy warrior mindset.
I think that's right. I don't have too much to add. I think there's a lot of theories about why the early 1990s, many of them very well supported by the data. It's really hard. At Pew Research Center, we are prohibited from kind of going beyond the data. So there's a lot of those theories, the political connection, the idea of a series of shocks and countershocks and the culture wars. I've even read theories about it has to do with the rise of the internet and people's exposure to in that way to different faiths. It's hard to point to one of those and quantify, it's this much politics and it's this much the internet, and it's this much this other thing, but I think there's probably an element, a little bit of all of that.
Can I just do one really quick follow-up?
Yeah.
Because I'm asking the data guy here, and there's a reluctant perspective,
which I appreciate.
Yeah.
Do we see anything like this in any other OECD country? Because if technology is playing an answer, if technology is playing a role, we should.
Yeah, so I was very intrigued and impressed by a recent article by Mark Chaves and David Vos. I forget which journal it was in. ASR? What's that?
AJS.
And they kind of take up the question, for many years, the United States was seen as an exception to what we saw in Europe and other parts of the industrialized world, which secularized much earlier and much more quickly than the United States appeared to secularize. And so then the question became, why is the United States exceptional? Why haven't we seen the same thing in the United States? And people offered a variety of theories for that, everything from lack of a social safety net in the United States to the religious free market in the United States. And it's been a while since I read it, so don't quote me on this. Read the article. I hope I don't get this wrong. But as I recall, I think the main argument that I was certainly impressed by that Chaves and Vos offer is that the United States actually wasn't so exceptional. Rather, what was happening was that immigration to the United States on the part of people who are on average are quite religious was serving to kind of mask a decline of religiousness among people who had kind of been here the whole time. So, again, it's been a long time since I read the article. I can't, but I was impressed by it, and that speaks to the question of to what extent do we see this. I think it happened earlier in many other parts of the developed world.
I will say this is not, again, putting sort of the causal connection off the table, but you do see sort of changing attitudes on a whole host of sort of questions based on human sexuality, whether that's premarital sex, morality of premarital sex, or same-sex relationships. So you do see in the, particularly in the 2000s, where you start seeing, you know, uptick of support. A lot of that's generationally driven, but that's also where you see the biggest uptick in non-religious identity too.
Rueda Abdelaziz from Huffington Post.
My question's a little bit pivotal to what we've been discussing for a little bit, but you mentioned that Islam and Muslims have been competing, I guess is a interesting word to use, for being the least favorable faith group or faith communities in the U.S. And I think what is intriguing is that another Pew Research study that I read not too long ago, that the majority of Americans don't know a Muslim personally and has contributed to a lot of the least favorable views. But at the same time, people who do meet a Muslim personally have favorable views of Islam and Muslims, generally speaking. So my question is, I'm trying to make sense of both of these different data sets, that folks who do come across Muslims have better views, but at the same time, it seems that at least consistently for the last 10 years that Muslims and Islam have been on the bottom tier of the list when it comes to faith communities. So how do I reconcile both of these different data sets together? I think I'm interested to see if there's anything more to elaborate on that. And then my second question had to do with access and methodology. So I feel like one thing that's really interesting, and I know you mentioned earlier that, you know, you could consistently and always improve on a survey question, has to do with various languages. I think a big chunk of the Muslim community are immigrant-based Muslims, and how we ask a question in English, for example, if I throw out the term Sharia law, is going to have completely different connotations in English than it would in, say, Arabic, right, the native language of Islam. And so are questions posed in different languages, are contexts like those taken into consideration when asking these questions, and how do we improve surveys to faith-based communities whose, you know, English is not their primary language or not the primary language, I guess, of the faith itself.
So I think Greg can probably better answer most of that, but I will say that views of Muslims have become more politicized, as almost everything has. For those of you, perhaps maybe a little too young or more paying attention, that, you know, during the George W. Bush era, he went out of his way, you know, post 9/11, to be, you know, extremely supportive of American Muslims, and it was, you know, only after his term that you sort of started seeing Republican politicians, in particular, just a few of them, sort of being, sort of taking a sort of more hard line on Muslims and tying it to immigration. As for, like, surveys of Muslims, I know Pew's done a couple, and it is really difficult. I know Greg can talk to this better than I can, but they've interviewed in you know, Urdu, Farsi, as well as English, and I think that's incredibly difficult and expensive, but it's also incredibly important to do.
Yeah, you are absolutely correct that knowing someone who is Muslim is connected with having more favorable views of Muslims and Islam. See the same pattern for many other religious groups. Knowing someone who's Jewish is connected with more favorable views of Judaism, and so on. I think part of what you see reflected there in the overall data then is that fewer Americans know someone who's Muslim than know people from other religious groups. And part of that is just a numbers thing. Muslims account for about 1% of the U.S. adult population, so the chances that someone might know someone who's Muslim are lower than the chances that someone will know someone who's Catholic or somebody from a larger religious group. So I think that's part of what's reflected there. You are also absolutely correct that we should always pay attention to kind of who's covered by our surveys, and specifically what languages are the surveys conducted in. In all of our surveys going back, I want to say, to 2011, and for a couple years prior to that, most of our surveys have been conducted in English and in Spanish. In addition to that, when we've conducted surveys of particular religious groups, we've used languages that are appropriate to those groups. So we've done three surveys of Muslims in the United States, one in 2007, one in 2011, and one in 2017. And in all three of those surveys, we did interviewing in Arabic, Urdu, and Farsi, in addition to English. And the translation process for those is very involved and very, very important. I'll never forget, of course, I only speak English. And I remember in 2007, getting back a translation and working with someone who was helping us review the translation. And we had a question that asked, this was so funny. The question in English asked, do you think that homosexuality should be accepted by society or not? Well, the translation in, I forget which of those three languages it was, it might have been Urdu, said, do you think that sexual morality should be accepted in society or discouraged in society? It's just like, it made absolutely no sense. And so we caught it, but that's the kind of, we go through that extended process, have someone translate it, have a native speaker review it, and then to the extent that there is a disconnect, the translator and the person who's reviewed it work together to come up with a good translation. And sometimes you even have to change the English version because, you know what, there's no way to get a good translation from English into another language. So it's critically important. I remember another time a few years ago we did a survey at Christmas time about how people were planning to commemorate Christmas. And one of the questions we asked was, do you intend to go caroling, to go singing Christmas carols? And the number of Hispanics who said they intended to go caroling was very, very high. We were like, what is going on? It was a translation issue. The translation into Spanish was something like, do you plan to sing Christmas songs? It wasn't about going caroling. It was about, and so, you know, we weren't able to use those data, but we have to, it's very important, and it's very important to try to get it right.
Holly Meyer from Tennessee, and then we have Curtis Yee, Ashin, Chris, others.
Hi, guys. I was wondering if there is data on who actually shows up to vote based on religious affiliation. Obviously, it changes every year, but in preparation for 2020, I know I will be asked to do some sort of religious voter story in my newsroom at the Tennessean, and white evangelical Christians certainly play a role in that. So I was wondering if there is sort of national data on who is the most likely to actually use that privilege or right.
Well, I mean, we know generally that folks who are less attached, regardless of what their religious identity is, less attached to congregations are less likely to engage in a host of political, social, civic behaviors. So the unaffiliated have much lower voting rates than members of most other religious traditions. We do need to be careful with the exit polls as a source of data. There's been sort of within the polling community some sense that the way that the exit polls are being conducted is not providing reliable demographic estimates. So when we do use those, they're often the best measures that we have, so we use them. For instance, on education, in 2016, there were some issues there. So I don't know if, Greg, you want to expound upon that. I mean, I know there's going to be some alternatives to the sort of traditional exits that's going to be available. There's the CCES, which is a political science survey that has religious identity and voting information as well. I don't know if there's any others.
Yeah, there's a. It's a really interesting question. First of all, you have to keep in mind that the exit poll asks a different question about religious affiliation than any other survey. Yeah. So they're not. You can't compare them apples to apples if you're looking for point estimates. But for many years in the exit polls, I want to say from like 2004 through 2014 or so, there's basically no growth in the share of people who said they have no religion among people who turned out to vote on election day, which was counter to what we saw happening in the general public. And it suggested that religious nuns, the political power of religious nuns was trailing their growth, the rate of their growth in the general population. That's begun to change in both 2016 and 2018. We have seen noticeable increases in the share of voters who say they have no religion. I want to say in 2018 it was 17%. Actually, I have it here and I'll look it up, but I think it was 17% in 2018 of voters in the midterm congressional election said they had no religion, which was up from what it had been in previous years. At Pew Research Center, we are doing more and more of our surveys among an online panel that we have recruited. It's called the American Trends Panel. These are people that we've recruited in the course of national surveys, and we've asked them if they would participate in ongoing surveys that we administer to them more or less once a month. And it's a fabulous resource. And among other things, it allows you to collect lots of data on the participants. And one of the things we've done in recent years is we've taken those people, those respondents, those 10,000 or so respondents, and we have matched them to data from voter files. Voter files are actual government records of who turned out to vote in any given election and who didn't. So that means for people in this American Trends panel, we don't have to rely just on whether or not the respondents said they voted. We can tell whether or not they showed up on election day. And some colleagues and I did a paper, did an analysis earlier this year at the conference of the American Association for Public Opinion Research, where we looked at the connection between religion and actual turnout. And I want to look back when I get back to the office at the presentation, but if I recall correctly, I think what the data showed is that atheists and agnostics actually aren't any less likely to turn out to vote than are the other groups. In fact, they tend than are religious groups. In fact, they tend to turn out at rates very much resembling what you see among evangelicals and Catholics and others. The group that exhibits lower levels of turning out to vote, as I recall, was religious nuns, people who say that their religion is just nothing in particular. So that was quite interesting, the fact that, at least in that sense, that sort of civic involvement, there's big differences among the nuns, between atheists and agnostics on the one hand, and the people who say they're simply nothing in particular on the other.
Right. There's a correlation of age and education, too. So atheists and agnostics tend to be more educated, higher levels of education, again, which is correlated with increased political activity.
Yeah. Yes, but this paper that I mentioned was controlling for that. It's controlling for age, controlling for education, controlling for other factors that we know to be associated with turnout.
Just to name it, as you consider drawing on data from these scholars in your own writing and in your own work, how big is the team at Pew? You didn't name that earlier.
Oh, gosh. We have a Pew Research Center, I want to say about 170 or 175 people who work there. We do a lot of different kinds of research. Religion is only one part of what we do. I want to say in our religion unit, there's about 25 people focusing on religion. And then within that, there's kind of, call it four main research groups. Conrad Hackett and his team of demographers do international demographic research. We have a team of people led by my colleague Neha Sehgal who do surveys internationally as relates to religion. And then I head up our team that conducts surveys about religion in the United States. We've also got a smaller team of people who track religious restrictions all around the world every year. And then many of the people among the 25 of us in religion, and one of the things that's so helpful in trying as best we can to turn the data into stories and into products that can be consumed by the general public and understood by a broad audience, we have a whole team of writers, journalists, editors who help us translate into plain English some of what we see in the data.
Big potential ally. You can follow Daniel on Twitter and see a lot of stuff he's writing. And there's the team's not quite as large
as me.
You're managing,
but we're growing. Actually, growing out the survey work at AAI, so that's pretty exciting.
Next up is Curtis Yee from Sacramento.
Greg, in your presentation on page 16, you noted that the United States was a big outlier from the rest of the world when it came to those who were praying regularly in terms of GDP and those who pray within the GDP. And I'm questioning why, do you have any understanding of why that is? Yeah. And then as a second part, as we look at immigration and trends of immigrants coming into the States, do we see similar trends and how does that affect the religious landscape? Is that, we've talked a lot about how that stemming decline in certain areas, is that growing? Are people changing their religious backgrounds? How does that changing the religious landscape?
I was thinking about your first question, so I'm going to need you to repeat the second one if you want an answer to it. Why is the United States an outlier? I don't know. I don't think we can point to data that can prove it's this or it's this much this and this much that. There are a number of ideas out there that people have offered to explain this. One is that the United States, unlike many of the other wealthy countries, doesn't have as much of a social safety net. So when people find themselves in need in the United States, they're not as able to turn to the state, to government resources for help. They have to turn somewhere. Where do they turn? Well, they need those religious networks. That's one idea. Another idea is that in the United States, unlike many of the countries, other wealthy countries, has no established state religion, which means that churches, denominations in the United States have to compete for members. They have to make themselves attractive, because if they don't have members, they will die. There is no dedicated state support for their upkeep and survival. So that in turn makes them, that need to compete for members makes them more attractive, makes them a more attractive thing for the population to participate in. I'm sure there's other theories as well. If I've missed anything important, please jump in. Again, that's not really a question that we can say the data show it's this, but those are some of the main ideas that have been offered.
And then the follow-up then, since the U.S. is so different from many other countries, when people immigrate to the United States, they come with their own religious backgrounds that they have. Do we see that those hold steady as people stay, or do they change?
Yes, they change. And that's an exaggeration and an oversimplification, but there is evidence that people's, generationally, people change after coming to the United States. We know, for example, that the share of the share of Latino immigrants who are Catholic, for example, is higher than is the share of Latinos who are the children of immigrants. And in turn, the grandchildren of immigrants is lower still. In other words, the share of Latinos who are Catholic declines generation by generation, which isn't to say that there aren't exceptions to that pattern. And there's less data available on other immigrant groups. But we certainly see evidence of, you can think of it almost as acculturation generationally among Latinos with respect to religion. I should also say, too, that religion is also changing in other parts of the world. So in Latin America, the share of people who identify with Catholicism is declining. So we know that the share of Latinos in the United States who are Catholic is declining. That's partly because when they get here, generationally, there's a fall off in that attachment to Catholicism. But we also know that there are more Latinos coming to the United States who aren't Catholic in the first place. So both things are at play. One other interesting point as relates to immigration, Latinos and Catholicism, we know that the share of Catholics in the United States who are Latinos is growing pretty rapidly. At least one-third of Catholic adults in the United States are Latinos. And that trend is likely to continue. And we know that because we know that among Catholic children, Latinos make up an even larger share than they do among adults. So the Latino share of the Catholic population is growing. It's likely to continue to grow moving forward. Meanwhile, the share of Latinos who are Catholic is declining pretty quickly. I think between the 07 and the 14 RLS, the share of Latinos who are Catholic dropped by 10 points. That means, looking ahead, that we might someday, I don't have a Conrad Hackett projection on what date this will be, but someday we could find ourselves in a situation where most Catholics in the United States are Latinos, even though most Latinos in the United States are not Catholic, which would be yet another very interesting development among so many others in the U.S. religious landscape. Does that help?
Nasheen Hussein from Chicago Tribune.
Okay, I have like six questions, so I'm going to try to consolidate as much as I can. There seems to be some connection globally between religiosity and nationalism, sometimes to like an aggressive point. Do those things correlate typically as you've seen them around the world if you do global stuff? And if so, I guess why, or just what there are places in Europe, for example, where religiosity does not seem to correlate, even though nationalism is still a heavy thing. And like, what is the difference? Why does that difference exist? I'm going to cut out like two questions, and then okay. So second question, the graph that you showed where white Democrats were the outlier, were there follow up questions or just follow up surveys to that where you dig into what non-white religious Democrats are finding in their religious experiences that whites are not? Mm-hmm. And then last question, do you have, as you look to the future of like these changing demographics, are there ways you're planning on changing, the type of questioning and this specificity of your questioning in so that it translates better to religions that are not Christianity? Because Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, all of these do not necessarily map in the same religious terms as the things that you'd use as factors in Christianity. And so are there ways to kind of work on that and fix that? These are for both of you, by the way. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Let's see. Religiosity and nationalism around the world is a little far afield from things I'm very familiar with. I can tell you that we just last year published results from a major survey that we conducted in Western Europe. I want to say about 25 countries, something in that nature, something in that range. And it looked at this exact question. Of course, Europe is less religious than the United States on average, but that survey included a whole bunch of questions about nationalism, about views of immigrants, about views of Muslims, about views of other religious groups, and they put together a scale. I think they called it the NIM scale, nationalism, immigration, and it might views of minorities, I think. And I believe what that scale showed was that Christians in Europe scored had more negative views than did people who weren't religious. But I would refer you to that report for the specifics on that. White Democrats, how is their religious experience different from that of African Americans and Hispanics? I think it's very different. One of the things we know is that many African Americans belong to historically Black Protestant denominations. So they are attending congregations with people from similar racial and ethnic backgrounds. Same thing is often true for Hispanic Catholics. So that's one thing that is distinctive about those communities. But I think the biggest difference, at least in the measures that we can look at, is in the basic one: how religious are these groups? Now, that gets to your third question: how can we refine these measures? How can we improve these measures? That's an extremely important question. I am aware that some of the basic questions we use to measure religiosity, do you believe in God? How important is religion in your life? Maybe especially, how important do you attend religious services? Those questions work quite well for Christians. They might not work as well for other groups. They probably don't work as well for other groups. And so what you have to do is try the best you can to collect data in specially designed surveys from other groups. So when you're surveying the general population, your questions have to work for the broadest possible group. In the United States, practically speaking, that means your questions have to work for Christians and people who come from a Christian background. It's something like 85 or 90% of all Americans are either Christians or were raised Christians. That's the common background that you have to design questions for. If you want more specialized data, you have to do different kinds of surveys. So we've done three surveys of Muslim Americans with questions designed specifically to measure religiosity among that population. We did a huge survey in 2013 among Jews in the United States, including people who identify their religion as Judaism, but also people who are ethnically or culturally Jewish by virtue of their ancestry. We had questions there designed specifically to get at what does being Jewish mean to you? We did a survey in 2011, I think, of Asian Americans and asked questions specifically for Hindus and Buddhists there. We did a survey of Mormons in 2011, asked questions specifically about Mormonism. So I think that's what you have to do. in general public surveys, just given the limitations of sample size, to say nothing of languages and so on, it's going to be very difficult to ask questions that are most pertinent to smaller religious groups. That doesn't mean those groups aren't important. It just means the way you have to collect those data is through specially designed surveys.
I won't add anything to the substance of that, but I will say that that the difficulty of conducting good public opinion research has been becoming increasingly difficult. RDD telephone surveys, so random digit dial telephone surveys, used to be the backbone of the industry, how we reached folks. We've shifted away from that for the most part, and they're increasingly common is using online panels, like the one that Pew has, and NORC, and Ipsos, which does these probability-based online panels, and those are high quality, but they're in panels, so the people are invited to be part of it, and so it's a little bit different than just dialing a random sample of folks, and the cost of all this stuff, you know, not many folks can either build their own panel, and even using panels like the ones I mentioned are expensive. So it just becomes a lot of times just a cost trade-off, and that's a little bit, you know, behind the curtain. But I think that's what's, you know, behind some of these decisions that researchers make. So it's incredibly important, but also it's fairly expensive. I think that's driving some of the decision-making.
Just real quick on the nationalism thing, might flag that we decided to try introducing sort of these biweekly podcasts with a journalist and a scholar each time. And we've done two that sort of touched on that a little bit, one with James Astle from The Economist that's on history, and another one from Paris with a guy called Pascal and Daniel Gobry. And we have a conference coming up in November that will pair Anne Applebaum and a guy named Matthew Goodwin, who just did a book called Nationalist Populism, in a dialogue about that. So once the proceeds from that come out, November 3rd, 4th, 5th, we'll try to, without overly spamming you, to at least give you the link if you want to weigh in on that.
Other people have thought a lot about this. Sociologists Sam Perry, Andrew Whitehead, and Joseph Baker. They might also be great people to consult about, especially Christian nationalists.
All right, we've got Brent Scher from the Free Beacon and Emily Bells from World Magazine.
Yeah, just a quick question. Has there been any data on whether affluence or, you know, college education has anything to do with becoming less religious or leaving the church? I'm just thinking of, you know, poorer communities tend to stay in the community where they grew up in, stay with the church, you know, that they went to when they were kids, stay near their family, while other people, you know, go to college, move to new places, have to find, you know, a new church family, which I know can be hard for people, and that sometimes is the reason why they maybe become, you know, non-churchgoers. Just wondering if that's something that's been touched on at all.
In terms of education, that I don't think is a major driver in disaffiliation. There's a great survey done out of UCLA, which is they interview incoming freshmen. And they see the same kind of trend in non-religious identity. So it's spiking. And again, it's happening over the same relative time period. So incoming freshmen today are much less religious than they were a couple of decades previous. And there's other data that suggests that education is not playing a major role. We do see in terms of, you know, as you mentioned, people with college educations more geographically mobile. That's associated with lower levels of religious attendance and stuff like that, too. So that's part of it, but I don't think it's a driver.
Go ahead. Yeah, please.
I didn't want to intervene.
No, go ahead.
Jump in. Hit that button, please.
Yeah, so Americans who attend religious services regularly have higher level of college education than those who don't. Attending religious services goes up with education all the way until grad school, and then it drops off. So grad school is really where it happens, not the BA. The other thing is, it's various studies over time have shown up until the 90s, going to college tended to have a stronger effect on pulling people away from religion, but then it switched in the 90s, so going to college, people who go to college are more likely to hang into religion than people who don't go to college. So it may seem counterintuitive in some ways, but the effect of going to college on one's religiosity has actually changed also in the 90s. for whatever reasons.
The only thing I would add is that among college graduates and those with less education, the share who say they're religious nuns isn't very different. So among college graduates in the 2014 study, 24% were religious nuns. Among those with less than a college degree, it was 22%, not really very different. Where there is a difference is that among college graduates, the nuns are much more heavily composed of atheists and agnostics as opposed to the nothing in particulars, whereas among people who have less than a college degree, among nuns with less than a college degree, they're much more likely to be nothing in particular with respect to religion than they are to be atheist or agnostic. So that's an interesting, I think that makes sense, but that's an interesting difference between the two.
Hey, so Daniel, I ambushed you with this right before we came back, so I thought I'd just ask you again, and you, Gregory.
Sure.
But I was thinking about how much institutional support I get from my church, and you know, when you face death or illness or whatever. So I'm wondering, in the post-religious communities, what institutions do you find that people turn to for support, or not just in those extreme situations, but just for community, I guess.
So this is a question I get often, and I should have a better answer given that. So yeah, whenever you know, sort of lay out the sort of dramatic changes in religious demography, people leaving, and as I mentioned, we were talking earlier, it's not that younger folks or folks who are leaving have no need of any type of community or belonging. They absolutely do. And so, the question is like, where do they turn? And you know, there's certainly online sources, whether it's Reddit, which has a online forum where I think over a million quote-unquote atheist Redditors are active, talking about a whole host of issues that are specific to their experiences, so like telling your mom that you're an atheist or your girlfriend's parents. So there's online communities for sure, but in terms of the sort of on-the-ground kind of places, I think honestly what's happening is the kind of everyday coffee shops, restaurants, bars, public parks, libraries are somewhat filling that role. We released a report not too long ago that looked at the impact of neighborhood amenities, so these types of commercial and public spaces and how that impacted a whole host of social outcomes. And basically what we saw is that people who lived in closer proximity to these type of places had greater levels of social trust. We're more engaged in a variety of different religious and civic activities, and we're sort of much less socially isolated. So this is more sort of me theorizing than absolutely answer your question. But I think that is what, like, that collection. It's not going to be any one institution, but I think that collection of institutions will step in and fulfill a variety of different needs.
Let's turn to Carly Stern. Ozzy.
Yes, so I'm just curious if you have a sense of kind of, I pose this to Daniel right before the break, but if you have a sense of the bar or threshold it takes for someone to identify as religious and whether that differs across denominations and age groups, like, you know, among millennials, are we seeing that they perceive, you know, the word religious a certain way? And so kind of that thin line between a nun and someone who loosely identifies as religious or perhaps culturally identifies as religious, If you kind of look at the age breakdowns or the demographic sort of breakdowns in that regard.
I don't know about age differences, but you've touched on a really interesting question. What does it mean for somebody to say they're religious, to say they're Catholic or Protestant or Jewish, and as opposed to being not irreligious? And I think it does vary from group to group. I think that there are some religious groups with which people are more comfortable saying, I am this, even if they're only nominally attached to that group. And other groups where, you know, if you, you don't see that kind of nominal connection. You're either all in or you're not really part of it. I also think that, we also know that there are many people who have a nominal or weak religious connection. We know that if you ask the same people about their religion over time, you ask them this year, ask them again the next year, ask them again the year after that, there's a fair amount of movement in the way people describe themselves. There's a fair amount of people who will say at time one, I'm Methodist, and at time two, I don't have any religion, and vice versa. A fair amount of people at time one will say, I have no religion, who at time two will say, I'm Lutheran. And those numbers, you know, they kind of offset each other. Those are the people with kind of a nominal connection to religion. They're not really changing. They're not switching. I mean, there's some switching that takes place over that short time. But these are people who have a weak connection. And depending on kind of what's front of mind, they might tell you in one survey, I have no religion, and another that I identify with the faith. So there's a lot of that. It was suggested to me, there's no way to prove this, but we did a big survey in 2011, I think, of Mormons in the United States. And Mormons, on average, are extraordinarily religiously observant. They, they say they believe in all of the teachings of their church. They say they attend religious services at extraordinarily high rates on every single measure. They're very religiously observant, more so than many other religious groups, much more so, for example, say, than Catholics. And it was suggested to me, we can't prove this with the data, but it was suggested to me after that report came out by observers, and that part of what's going on there has to do with what it means to be Mormon. If you stop believing those things, if you stop participating in those activities, you wouldn't then tell someone you're Mormon. So who calls you on the phone and says, what's your religion? So the people who tell you they're Mormon when you call them on the phone mean they're Mormon. The people who tell you they're Catholic, they might mean, I go to church at least once a week, I go to confession at least once a year, you name it. Or it might mean people who say, I was raised Catholic, I go to church at Christmas and Easter, I guess I'm Catholic. Kind of includes both groups of people. And I do think that ratio can vary from group to group.
I would just add that on the other side, so looking at the non-religious folks, we do see some amount of fluidity in panel data. So people who are identify as atheists in time one, maybe in time two they're agnostic, maybe in time three they're just nothing in particular. And I think in part this is, Greg alluded to this, that, you know, when it's not attached to an institution or any other type of sort of social constraint, it becomes much easier to wake up and sort of say, yeah, I'm agnostic today, I guess. I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek there, but I mean, without that constraint, I think it just becomes a lot easier to sort of move among those different categories.
Cassie.
Yeah, so I was wondering if you had any data, for lack of a better word, of people like transferring between denominations, and if there's any like reasoning behind that of why they would switch, or if a certain denomination is growing more than others. You know, some of them are so similar that I'm wondering if people really associate with one denomination, or just like, I'm a Christian, I live in, you know, maybe a rural area, and this is the closest church.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you asked. This is one of my favorite subjects. Yes, we have asked this, and the way we've done it in these big religious landscape surveys is we ask people, what's your religion, as we talked about. And then later in the survey, we ask them, thinking about when you were a child and what religion were you raised. And so we can then compare those two and see how many people currently identify with a religion that's the same as the one in which they were raised and how many don't. And what the data show are that if you treat Protestantism as just one group, that's a religion. Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, none, other faiths as well, but Protestantism is one group, then fully one-third of the U.S. public currently has a religious identification that's different than the one in which they were raised. They've switched religions. If you treat Protestantism as three separate groups, evangelical Protestantism, mainline Protestantism, and historically black Protestantism, there's a little bit more noise here, I can get into why that is, then that figure rises to 42%. So more than 4 in 10 American adults currently identify with a religion that's different than the one in which they were raised. The single, we talked about Catholics being having suffered the single net losses, in the biggest losses in that process of religious switching. It won't come as any surprise to know that the group that has benefited the most is the nuns. There are 4 people in the United States who say they've become nothing after having been raised as something for every 1 person who says they are now something after having been raised as nothing. And in total, 18% of U.S. adults, almost 1 in 5, are people who now say they have no religion, even though they were raised in a faith, mainly Christianity. Why do they switch? Why do people switch religions? That depends a lot on where they're coming from and where they're headed. The people who leave Christianity, the people who leave Catholicism for Protestantism, for example, tend to do it for very different reasons than people who leave Catholicism to become nothing. But if we focus in just on the nothing, people who become no atheist, agnostic, nothing in particular, people give a lot of reasons. Dan touched on this. The thing that's always struck me is that the number one reason we can see in the data people give for that is that I just gradually drifted away. And when we talk to religious leaders, pastors, who are interested, intensely interested in these trends, and they want to know why are people leaving, why are people leaving? That's a hard question to answer, because for many people, there's not a single precipitating event. There might not even be a single moment in time before which I was something and after which I was nothing. It's a gradual process. It's a gradual drifting away, and many things can come into it. So that's a very brief answer, but yes, there is a lot of religious churn in the United States, people changing their religious identities.
Do you see a change in the churn rate between the 2 studies?
I don't think so. We did change a few things about measurement, so it's tough to get an apples-to-apples comparison, but I don't think we can say that all of a sudden between 07 and 14 there was a dramatic shift in how many people had switched religions. But if you think about it, that makes sense, because that's, for that to happen, that would have had to mean that a lot of change took place in just in those 7 years. But that would be pretty surprising to observe that, in part because we know people tend to, when people change religions, they tend to do it early in their lives, which is another important point, actually. When you think about religious change, it's important to remember that what we're seeing is not so much people in their 30s and 40s and 50s leaving their religious attachments. It's more about generations. It's more about, to be blunt, people dying and being replaced by a new generation of people with different kinds of attachments to religion.
Jack, Nosheen, and Chris.
Just a real quick one. It jumped into my brain earlier when you were talking about, you know, how religiously unaffiliated they seem to be ticking back up in terms of showing up on election day. But you were also talking about, both y'all, the religious people of color who identify as Democrats or like look more like Republicans in terms of their religious turnout. But does that also transfer into election turnout as well? Like, for lack of, to grossly oversimplify it, are religious people of color some of the highest turnout rates in the Democratic Party?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know within the Democratic Party how it varies. I do know that among African Americans in particular, there was a big, a significant bump in turnout during the Obama elections. But I don't know that we could attribute that to religion necessarily.
You know, probably a couple factors at play. We did see, spikes among African American women who tend to be most connected to and committed to their church or congregation. They tend to have higher rates than African American men. But again, there's education, age, and there are other factors at play as well.
It's a really interesting question. How do turnout rates vary by race and religion within the parties? But I don't know the answer to it. That's interesting.
So it seems like what is happening is that the role of faith communities is changing in the States, and as it has elsewhere. Are you keeping track of how specific religious organizations are changing their ways of connecting with their congregants in that, so you were saying earlier that people are finding connection in places, in public places, like coffee shops and things like that. And I think it seems like some religious organizations are doing a better job of creating like events where people can come to hear a speaker or, mm-hmm. you know, doing volunteer work or something like that. Are there trends of religious organizations doing more and more of that because they're trying to get people back?
I'm going to suggest that we hold that one live alongside of Chris, and then we'll have one last answer, and then we'll take a brief break before we actually do break bread. Chris, do you want to just weigh in as well?
Yeah.
No, okay. Seriously? All right. You sure? Yeah, of course, you got a session. You can work it into your session. All right.
So I would just say quickly that in non-denominational churches, like some of the mega churches, they've developed really sophisticated programs to, you know, get people who are single, people who with young children. They offer like golf outings and you know, they have some of the coffee shops, some of the larger ones. And so they are trying to appeal to a lot of the different needs. And then I think particularly folks are being cognizant about young adults who are religious and their particular needs and how that's different from older folks. So I think, yeah, there is a lot of stuff that's being done.
We have not collected any systematic data at Pew Research Center about congregations at all, including the ways they might be responding to the changing religious landscape. A few ideas for people you might check with. You might check with Scott Thumma, I think I'm saying that right, Thumma at Hartford Seminary. He does a lot of research on megachurches and may well have systematic data on how they're changing their outreach. Another option might be to Mark Chaves at Duke. He conducts the National Congregation Studies. And then there's a group called the ASARB, the Association of Statisticians of American Religious Bodies. And they may also have systematic data over time on how this is changing. Maybe none of them have it, but if anybody did, that's where I would start.
Terrific. So we will look forward to you know, keeping that conversation alive and going. And if you write on it, please let us know. If you write on any of these themes, please let us know and flag it. And we'll try to help push it around a little bit as well. I think Lily has done some good research in this space and funds a lot in that area. Mm-hmm. And the American Religion News Association just gathered for its convention this past week, I guess it was.
No, next week.
Next
right?
week, coming up. Yeah. Coming up, that's right. Yeah. In Las Vegas, which will generate a lot of material on the same line. So we have a 10-minute break, and then lunch is served next door again. Please remember to, I'm sure you saw that there's a wireless code to get on. If you haven't seen that, there should be cards around, and this is the card. We've got at least one or two up here. Hashtag exists. Enjoy the break, and lunch will be served at 12 o'clock. Thanks very much to our speakers.
All right. Thank you.